presentations, water cooler chats, groupthink meetings to kick up thought showers. Office life can be dull. Learn what's happening in nature and on the farm every week with Mairead Lavery from the Farmer's Journal.
53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cent. You'd be surprised by Anne Frank having dirty jokes in her diary. Well, that's a shock. Everyone has a bit of devilment in them, says one texter. Paul says, I never thought about her having a sense of humour. To me, she's always been associated with such dark, horrible times. It only makes sense that she has a typical teenager's mentality, says Paul. Well, of course. And also, you normalise things, even if it's, you know, from the kind of prism of looking back. We go, God, that was an awful time. But people are still trying to live their lives and would still laugh and still try to have a bit of crack. There's a George Soros, who's like the billionaire, but, you know, he funds various causes. And of course, if you're a right wing person, you think of him the devil incarnate. George Soros once said that because he is originally from Hungary, I think he was a teenager growing up there. And he said that he was, you know, 13 or 14 and there was a period there, and it was one of the best periods of his life because it was so exciting. Of course, he didn't realise what was going on in other parts of Europe. He didn't realise just how appalling it all was, but it was kind of exciting to a teenager. Of course, now that the particular quote has been taken out of context so many times that that you can find things on the internet supposedly proving that he was a Nazi collaborator, though he was 14, so I don't know what use you'd be to the Nazis particularly. This can't be true, says another texter. We've had her diary for decades. We're only finding this out now. This has to be a joke. One, this guy works in the Anne Frank Museum. He runs it. So I assume he hasn't gone mad and decided to start making jokes about Anne Frank. The page was covered up. And for whatever reason, they kind of let it be for a while. And I suppose probably technology, they've managed to get it open without doing the other pages any damage. We were talking as well about the environmental impact of having a cat, in the sense that a lot of dogs and cats, well, most dogs and cats eat meat, and that has an environmental impact. Texter says, my cat loves grated cheese. But along with his meaty or fishy dishes, like a side dish, if you will, that's, I hope that your cat isn't lactose intolerant. Someone else talked about, you know, giving the dog a special food on their birthday or at Christmas or that kind of stuff. I did opine that they don't know it's their birthday or Christmas. But you celebrate a dog's birthday because they are like a member of the family. I'd be raging if my kids told me my special day didn't matter. Does that make me greedy? No, that makes you a human being. You go home now and tell your dog, your next birthday, we're going to completely ignore it. See what reaction you get. Absolutely none. You say dogs don't know it's a special day, but we shell out money like it's going out of fashion on one-year-olds and two-year-olds' birthdays. They don't have a clue what's going on either. Why waste your time and money on those parties? Amanda reckons. Well, I would imagine if you suggest to the parents of said one-year-olds or two-year-olds that it's a waste of money to have a birthday party for their little baba, I think you wouldn't get a welcoming response to that. Plus, a two-year-old would know. Two-year-olds do know what a birthday cake looks like. The problem with a two-year-old is they think every birthday is their birthday. Not just they're unfamiliar with the concepts of birthday. And those kind of events, especially the first birthday, are for the entire family, especially when it's the first child. It's something to be celebrated with the grandparents and all the rest of it. Yes, the one-year-old mightn't know that it's their birthday, but they're a human being. They're not a dog. What in the name of God is green Mexican rice? Somebody said they serve this to their pet. I'm a bacon and cabbage kind of man, says Christy. Green Mexican rice sounds like it's been eaten already. Yes. Thank you. That was a very vivid description, Christy. Well done. Big Dave, though, was angry. He's always angry. He says he's had it up to here with these vegetarians. And now they're trying to push it on our dogs. Let me open that fella's eyes. Dogs don't eat salad. Yes, no, they don't. Dog. Big Dave. Time for farming.
Dogs, yeah.
Dogs don't eat salad. You know,
no, they don't eat salad. No, they won't eat tomatoes or they won't eat scallions and they don't like lettuce either. We've two dogs at home, Millie and Rog. And Rog is all, you know, jumping around everything and always excitable and all the rest of it. Millie's very cool and calm. But the one thing she knows is if she can get me in the kitchen by myself, she's liable to get a couple of treats. So she waits until the other fella's asleep, and then up she gets and kind of saunters in, waiting for something. She never does it when he's kind of up and about and around the place, you know. So far smarter dog that, altogether.
Cute
yeah.
house.
Yeah. Oh. But the Anne Frank house, that was interesting, yeah. I was there once upon a time.
And it's tiny, isn't it? The stairs are so narrow.
Yeah, it's so narrow. And you just think of the big press, like behind which they were living up in the attic. And I don't know how they managed to survive for as long as they did, because the least sound, you know, the piece of light, anything. And actually the whole job of providing the food, you know, it was hair raising because there were so many people that needed to be fed. And sure, you know, there was absolutely no rations available either. So it made a big impression because, and you know, there's millions of people have walked through that house, and still there's something terribly, terribly authentic about it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think you're dead right. It's technology and being able to open the pages or to, you know, find out that information, because technology allows it, and it doesn't mean that you damage any of the other pages.
Yeah, I think, well, also there was probably an element they wanted to respect her wishes, because she's the one who covered them over, it seems.
Yeah.
She didn't want the parents to know she was, you know,
yeah,
filthy,
yeah, she was
in pages.
Yeah, yeah, no, but
so a typical teenager. Then.
Yeah, there's a very good online website for Anne Frank House as well. A lot of, not just written content, verbal or, you know, video content and everything on it. It's very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So
anyway,
this weather, I assume, is great news. This
is
fantastic.
Oh, good God. Imagine, it's only a month ago since I was coming in here talking about the weather and how bad it was. What a difference a month makes. Just one thing in terms, before we even talk about farming. If you're out in the country, there's a load of people in cars now, maybe driving up motorways or driving the roads. Pull in somewhere safely. Give yourself 5 minutes to get out of the car, maybe get over a gate and have a look at the countryside at the moment.
Mm.
The Irish countryside is just, it's absolutely magnificent at the moment. I mean, you've got the white thorns. You talk about cherry blossom festivals in Japan. We should have nearly white thorn in festivals in this country. It's absolutely laden down with blossom. It's just magnificent. And coming up underneath it is the cow parsley. And you see it on hedgerows. Now, it's like, I described it this week in the journal as, it's like champagne, frothy champagne.
Mm.
I mean, because it's just, you know, you've got the cow parsley coming up on one side and the laden down hedgerows on the other side. If you look towards the hills at all, they look like Paul Henry paintings.
Mm.
I mean, they're just absolutely the same as these paintings. The hedgerows are full. You've got lime trees, with this beautiful lime-coloured leaves. They look so luxuriant and are competing against the beech. And the beech now are real acid green colour. You have the, you know, just what's growing, the daisies. You've got dandelions. You've got so many stuff in the hedgerow. And then the bird song. Just get out of the car and listen to the birds. You would do your heart good.
Yeah, it would. Yeah.
Really would. And people, you know, they're driving there, they're stuck in traffic. Pull into the nearest place, have a look and just stop and breathe it in. And if you're anywhere near a hayfield, get out and have a look at it. Because there's something terribly, I don't know, there's something terribly evocative about a hayfield. And there's farmers all over the country for the last few days been watching the weather barometer and been doing the 3 to 5 day weather forecast to see will they or won't they chance hay. Now, because it really is like that. Because if you don't save it, and it is, you know, we use the terms advisedly, you save the hay.
Yes.
If you don't save it, you lose that whole 8 or 10 acre field and a whole crop off of it, which, given the way the year has been and the way last year turned out, could be an absolute disaster this time next year. So saving the hay is what's going on at the moment. There's hay being made, I'm told, around the country. A lot of people get burned so badly with hay that they swear they will never go back to it again. I know I went grey with hair or with hay. And I never, ever, ever forget it. But making hay gave me some of my best memories and some of my worst memories. Worst memories when I would be responsible for dropping that field of hay and not saving it in time. Like, I mean, one year the mist was coming in from Kerry right across the hills. You could see it in the distance. The baler was in the field and the straw or the hay gone from this lovely crisp dry thing, literally, you know, dampened. It was like somebody sprayed shower water
over
it.
How quickly can that happen?
It can happen in the space of 20 minutes where we are, because the weather coming in, and you couldn't get it baled up quick enough. And then even when it got baled up, it didn't have time to ripen.
But in that scenario, would it be? But of course, you've paid for the baler and all that expensive stuff.
Yeah, but all done. But you see, the thing is, what it does, it gets mouldy.
Right.
Hay has to be dry. There's no tactile feeling about silage. Silage is silage.
Yeah.
You know, a brown bale silage, pit silage, there's no real feel about it. But there's something awfully tactile about hay. People pick it up, they smell it, they pull it apart. You know, they test it in another part. They cut it down. It's shaken out after a day to dry out. You're feeling it. Is it ready for the second turning? You know, is it ready for baling? You know, it's an absolute tactile thing. You have to understand what you're actually producing here. But above all, it must go into the bale, either the big bale or the small square bale. It has to go in dry. That's the most important thing. Because other than that, you put it in a shed. I've seen it at home when I was a small kid. You're piling up loads of hay and then 2 days later, there's steam coming up out of it and you're pulling it all apart and throwing it back out again. And it's... you know, it's gone mouldy because it hadn't been dry enough.
Gosh.
You remember a whole pile of washing that you take out of the dryer or something and it's not, and you open it up and the whole middle of it is still wet.
Mm.
Like that's exactly what you're kind of talking about. And it can be a disaster. But nowadays, the weather forecast is really, really very good. Whether the crops are ready for to be, you know, made hay of. Often you can maybe get this bit of good weather in the end of May and you mightn't get it again until August, and then the crops have gone too, you know, they're too stemmy, they're not really of great feeding value for animals. But
how much of a window then do you need?
You need a solid 6 days. You need 5-6 days anyway, depending on how heavy the crop is. If it's a heavy green crop, it'll going to take that little longer to dry. Now, mind you, if we hit 25 or 6 degrees temperatures, it wouldn't be too bad. But it's if you know anyone with a hay field, you know, maybe even, now this would be totally off the wall, I suppose, but, you know, there's nothing like a picnic in a hay field. There really isn't.
Mm.
Tomato sandwiches, banana sandwiches, chicken sandwiches, homemade lemonade, hot tea, you know, a bit of sponge cake or little scones or something like that. There's something about it. It really does evoke memories for people. And I think maybe because haymaking...
Tater sandwiches. Cheese and tater sandwiches.
No, that would have been a townie sandwich.
Still though.
But there's something about... I don't know what it is. Maybe it's because for people of my generation anyway, and even, you know, for my kids... There was always big numbers of people around, you know. It had to be saved.
Yeah.
It had to be done. So everybody helped everybody. And, you know, you can just, you know, the children's job, we wouldn't have had too many in the round bales. It would have been the small little square bales, you know, which are just kind of about the height of a 10-year-old.
Mm.
And, you know, they can just about manage them if it's nice and dry hay. And, you know, we used to make houses in the hay. You know, you could build them up and rack them and you'd have different rooms in the houses and castles and lookouts and all sorts of things. That is until, you know, you had to stack them up. And then they have to be stacked.
Mm.
So that's one row of work that has to be done. Then they have to be loaded onto trailers to be brought into a shed. That's two loads of work. They have to be unloaded, three. They have to be stacked again, four. And then they have to be taken out. So what really got rid of the small bales for most people was the amount of handling. They didn't have like 10 kids around the place anymore and two uncles to do the job. But it's one of the jobs that's happening right now, and it's a lovely thing to do.
And lots of people are texting in and you were evoking memories in them. Carol says, "You've transported me back to when I was 9 on my parents' farm. We would eat banana sandwiches and white bread with a bit of sugar sprinkled over the bananas.
Absolutely,
delicious."
Yes, absolute gourmet. But in just, you know, the white thorn, going back to the look of the countryside at the moment, you know, maybe we should have a white thorn festival or something because it is absolutely stunning. The other job that's going on, if we've time to get to it, is shearing.
Yeah.
Sheep shearing. Why now? Well, up to now, you need hot weather for the wool to rise in the yow. If the wool hasn't risen, you know, it's very hard to shear. She can get cut. It's difficult for the shearer. But after the last couple of weeks, we're ready to shear. I know at home now we're hoping to do it on Saturday. Why would you want to shear? Well, there's a couple of really good reasons. One is that with the weight of wool on a yow, she can go over on her back very quickly. She can be sitting down there, perfectly happy, chewing the cud, get to stand up and then roll over.
And then they're open to attack.
They're open to attack by crows. We've explained this before. And they literally can die in the space of 10 or 15 minutes.
Mm.
I mean, awful, awful thing to happen. So you need to get the wool off them. And And the other problem is blue fly attack. If there's any dung on them at all, any little bits of, you know, and this is where the argument about tails and no tails comes into it. Because if you've got a yo with, you know, a lot of dung on her backside, she's much more, she's sitting duck for yeah. these bloody blue bottles. So anyway, all that needs to be got off. And but this year, I'm afraid to say that we're looking at wool prices of 55 cent a kilo. That would have been in comparison to 140, €1.40 3 years ago, 2015. Crikey. Yeah, so at the moment we're looking at, for every yo that you shear, we're looking at 68 cents in the red. That's how much it's going.
So you'd lose money.
You're losing money, yeah. A flock of 60 yos where you've got somebody to come in to shear them, it's going to cost you €40. That's after selling the lamb, selling the wool. So,
and what happened? Why is wool prices down so low?
Well, we've been praising the Chinese because they've been buying they've been buying our milk.
Second Chinese.
They've been buying our milk. They're thinking hard about buying our beef. They've already put in a couple of orders, but they've decided against buying our wool. They're not buying the wool at the moment, and that seems to be the big problem. Where they're buying their wool now from is Australia and New Zealand. It's the merino wool. It's a softer, lighter wool than what we produce up here.
Mm.
But the merino wool, now I suppose there probably are a couple of flocks of merino sheep in Ireland, but I mean the majority wouldn't be the merino wool type at all. Anyway, that's the reason why. So it's a job. It still has to be done, whether you get the money or not.
Not, yeah.
What some farmers do now is, well, you know, they put away a couple of years' supply in the hope that, you know, in 3 or 4 years' time, the price might go up. And once wool is properly folded, and there's an act to how to fold a fleece as well, and you get beautiful, a day working with a flock of sheep in shearing, you get the most gorgeous soft hands because of the lanolin that comes out of the wool.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it's a big job because the shearers, I honest to God don't know how they manage to survive with their backs, because they're literally bent over the whole time. And I mean, good shearers, you know, you could they'll do maybe 500 yos in a day.
It's hard work.
It's really hard work. And it's generally done in sunny weather because you can't shear fleeces when they're wet. And try putting a flock of sheep inside in a shed overnight if it's threatening rain. You know, by the morning, they'll have messed themselves up unbelievably. And they'll be wanting to get out, you know, because you won't be feeding them silage or anything like that. So it's very hard to in dampish weather, to get a flock shorn properly. But in dry weather, you can get it done and you can save it and, you know, roll it up and put it into these big bags and nice and tightly packed. And, you know, you can put it up in a loft or somewhere like that. But anyway, that's the price, I'm afraid. That's the advance price.
Yeah.
55 cent a kilo. And on that kind of a size of a flock, we're talking about being down, what is it, €40.
God, that's
heartbreaking. After doing the whole thing.
What's the row down in Galway about the stone walls?
The row down in Galway? Yeah, this is interesting. I love the stone walls down in Galway. Absolutely love them. And there, over the past couple of years, we've been doing different environmental schemes like the REPS and GLOS and the rest of it. And what a part of it doing was to restore stone walls. I was down in the Burn recently with a man doing a tour. Shane Cavanagh is his name. He's a farmer and he's a tour guide on the Burn. And he demonstrated about stone walls. Now, Kinvara isn't too far. It's literally the gateway to the Burn where this is going on. But he said, you know, when the Incas were making sacrifices in South America, there were clever men building stone walls.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. Yeah.
When Christopher Columbus discovered America, there were clever men building stone walls. And he says, and when they're walking on the moon again, there'll be clever men building stone walls. So they're old stone walls. This is an area of road now that we're talking about, the N67 between Kinvara and Ballindareen, where there's roadworks going on, and where the council is saying, or rather it's the Transport Ireland organisation, Transport Infrastructure Ireland, they're saying, OK, we need to put down timber poles and mesh wire instead of these stone walls. So this is all about this, what they call it, forgiving roadsides. So if you want to have your stone wall, you're going to have it inside the mesh wire and the posts. Now, seemingly there's...
In case it rolls down in front of a car, I suppose, is the concern. Yeah.
Or maybe that you crash into it. But anyway, these people are saying that, or the farmers and the residents down around Kinvara are saying that there's been people, these stone walls have existed for hundreds of years on this route, and that they shouldn't be taken down, that they're an intrinsic part to it, that it's part of the burn. Now, in reply... The transport people are saying, okay, maybe there's a where the walls are in good condition in the southern end of the scheme, they'll be okay. But where the walls are in bad condition, that's where they're going to be putting up the mesh and poles. But anyway, we haven't heard the end of it, and it's farmers actually shouting about heritage here and holding the stone walls.
Which isn't the usual way, it's usually
farmers being
part of the
pulling, dragging and screaming into it.
Loads of people texting in about, hey,
people are saying,
I'm sitting here with tears in my eyes thinking about my dad trimming hay. Someone else says, there are a few things as pleasurable as opening a good bale of hay on a short, dark winter's day. The smell of it, the touch of it, the way it moves as it's shaken out. Both man and animal feel it. It's summer in winter. Someone else says, my advice, find someone in life who talks about you like Mairead talks about hay. And Gary in Kilbride says, Mairead talks about hay like Nigella talks about food. I'm getting all flustered. Mairead, thanks for coming in to us. Mairead Lavery from the Farmers Journal there. Back in a couple of minutes. More from around the world on Moncrief every Tuesday from 2:40.
Great.